It's good to see all of you on this beautiful Sunday morning. Thank you for being here and joining us this morning. It's great to have you. A couple things. I just wanted to put a plug in for the Bible study that we're going to do. We will be studying various texts beginning when we begin that study, learning how to study the Bible for all it's worth. And I don't know how many of you have a study Bible. Some of you may not have a study Bible. If you don't, what's that place out there at the mall, Rocky? It's right there by, across from Planet Fitness all the way, Ollie's. Like Ollie's, you can get like a study Bible pretty inexpensively if you don't have one. And so if you'd like to join us for those weeks, you're welcome to. And the beautiful thing is that when you have different translations and maybe even different editions, you have different material. And so when we get together, there'll be some synergy as well where we can learn. And so there'll be several different layers that we'll study, and I'll try to lead you through, sequence of some of what I do and what other pastors do when it comes to elucidating the scriptures in a helpful manner. And so I just wanted to put a plug in for that, and hope that you can join us. And if you want to bring somebody, great, that would be good as well. Okay, so I'm kicking back into the First Peter series that we're doing. You were made for this moment. And this is an interesting passage that we'll be talking about today. I had a picture associated with this that I thought was included, but I guess maybe it's not there. Is it there? Maybe it didn't come through, but in any case, this text is, one of those texts where you could spend a month of Sundays on. And it is a text that's really, in many respects, a very important text. It's a text that in some ways has a... there are some ways in which it is overly emphasized, in some ways in which it's underly emphasized, and it can lead you into places where maybe you don't want to go or shouldn't be. So I took a picture last night just because I was surprised once I started, really sort of doing some of the digging. So all around me, I had books piled trying to get at what was behind. Yeah, there it is. And there were others that showed up later, but it's a complex text. And so I want to be able to get to this particular text today as much as possible. I may have to follow up with another. This is also a text that should never be read without reading Romans chapter 13, verses 1 through 7. This text should always be read in conjunction with that particular text, and then our whole host of other smaller texts I think bring it to light as well. So let's go ahead and read it first, and then I'll make some additional comments before we get into the whole of the text itself. So this is about Christian conduct to the state and society in an adversarial world. So Peter begins in this portion of the text by saying, "Be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether it be to the emperor as supreme or to governors as sent by him to punish those who do evil and to praise those who do good. Live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but living as servants, the word there is doulos, so slaves. In other texts, the Apostle Paul might use the word bond servant, but Peter uses the word doulos here, slaves of God. Verse 17, honor everyone. Love the brotherhood. Fear God. Honor the emperor. So, as you hear and as you read this text, you might be curious about what was going on in that day, at that time, in that place. But you can't help but wonder what its application might be today. How would that apply to us today with what, you know, is going on not just here, but throughout the world? I don't know if you're following what's going on in Amsterdam, of all places, but it's truly remarkable. And so the question becomes, and not only that, I think that when Christians read a text like this, in the back of their mind, what they're looking for is some kind of an answer, some kind of a solution, some kind of an approach about, like, how do we stop the bad man from giving us so much pain? And that's not the orientation of this text at all. The text is really much bigger, much broader, much more poignant, much more powerful than simply that. So how are we to read and understand and apply this passage? And so the very first thing that we need to do in understanding this passage is understanding the historical context, and that it's crucial to understand the historical context. So it would be very easy to lift this passage up and apply it only to our time. And if we did that, we would not be fair to the text itself. Interestingly, this letter was written during the reign of Emperor Nero, who reigned from AD 54 to AD 68, so 14 years. This letter that Peter wrote was written around 62 or 63 AD, so right in the middle of Nero's reign. So here's Peter writing to Christians, saying, be subject to all institutions, to the emperor, who is the first citizen, which is what is meant by supreme. And later on, it goes on to say, honor the emperor. The very last phrase of this text is honor the emperor. Now, I don't know how much you know about Emperor Nero. Nero became emperor when he was 16. And his mother, Agrippina, was determined to rule through him. She was no shrinking violet. She was no matronly, sweet-natured woman that just wanted to see their grandchildren bounce on her knee. That's not who she was. She was very, very ambitious politically. And so much so, and tried to control Nero so much so, that Nero, in AD 59, had her murdered. Now, around that time, Nero had married for the second time. And I always have difficulty saying her name, but I'll just call Propania, something like that. I have it on my phone, but I shut my phone off. Propania was in her third marriage. Nero was in his second marriage. She was no less ambitious than Agrippina. She had a lot of political ambition as well, and tried to counsel Nero early on to have his mother killed because she was in the way. Now, it seemed as if their marriage was a fairly decent marriage, at least at first, but clearly after Nero had his mother murdered. He had shown signs of demise psychologically before that, but it was particularly after he murdered Agrippina that he began his descent. And he did some pretty horrible things. Some really horrible things to Christians, where, you know, Rome burned and he blamed them. And I'll have more to say about that in a little bit because it fits within this overall context. But Nero was so unbalanced psychologically that his wife Proserpina, when she was pregnant, made him angry. And she was pregnant well into their pregnancy, and he kicked her to death in a fit of anger. Interestingly, he mourned for her the rest of his life. He died when he was 30, committed suicide after being declared an enemy of the state by the Senate. So when you read the Apostle Peter, all of that kind of stuff is in the background. So if you think you, as a Christian today, have a difficult time, a challenge with what it means to honor governing authorities, Christians back then had maybe at that time even more of a challenge than what we do today. Does this make sense to you? You see why context matters, why culture matters? Because it's all in the background here of what, as Peter is writing. So, number one, this is the most important takeaway that we need to have when we read this text. The primary exegesis of 1 Peter 2, 13 through 17 is about the guidance and exhortation the Apostle Peter gives to persecuted first century Christians who are citizens of Rome to submit to standard societal rules and codes in order to avoid additional criticism and opposition. That's the primary purpose of this whole text. This, as well as others, that is the primary purpose of this text. And I'll get into that in a bit more. But here, now, so this is just one example of a number of the different societal codes that the Apostle Peter was saying to Christians at the time. He's saying, look, there are these societal codes that do not run counter to our Christian faith that you need to be amenable to, that you need to submit yourself to, because if you don't, you're just going to attract more attention and more persecution. So here are the others in the whole of the text. So he addresses the citizen and the state in 1 Peter 2, 13 through 17. Then he addresses slaves to masters in 1 Peter 2, 18 through 25, which will be an interesting sermon, don't you think? And I understand that in today's context, it's very easy to say, well, if you were a Christian, you should have just given up slavery. You should have critiqued it. You should have protested against it and all of those kinds of things. And when you say that, you have no idea how deeply embedded the institution of slavery was in the early first century throughout the entire world. And it'd be almost like saying to a teenager, you have to give up a cell phone for the rest of your life. Like, are you kidding? There is no way I could ever do that. I'm being a little facetious. But I'm saying to you that the institution of slavery, there were roughly 1 million people who lived in the city of Rome. Over 600,000 of them were slaves. in the city of Rome. So it was an institution that had to be addressed. Then he talked about the family, in particular wives, in 1 Peter 3:1-6, and then a comment about husbands in 1 Peter 3:7. Here's what is meant by codes that Peter was writing into to instruct the believers that he was trying to help endure persecution of his day. Many ancient household codes were set in the context of discussions of city management and included instructions on how to behave towards the state, as well as toward parents, elders, friends, members of one's own household, etc. We have those same kinds of codes in our culture today. There are certain things, like I was working at Auto Plus yesterday morning, and one of the people who come in and deliver different parts to different, so they're transporters. They come in and they grab some parts, and then they take them to another store, and they deliver them there. There's a woman that comes in. She's about 50-some years of age, and that's her job. Now, I don't know if you've ever picked up a brake disc before that you use for brakes. They're pretty heavy. And some of them are for big trucks, and they're even heavier. And so she comes in and she said, I need help. I can't put this in my vehicle by myself. So I'm glad to help you. So I took it out, helped her put it in. And there, sitting in the front seat of her vehicle, is an 18 or 19-year-old man. Now, what code do you think was violated there? Because I'm telling you, if I was the dad, you know, there would be a discussion at least. Right? So we have those kinds of codes in our own culture today. So then he goes on to say, according to contemporary aristocratic ideals, the household mirrored the government of a city-state. So public obligations and obligations with the household were commonly treated together. So how the state was run, there's a parallel between that and how the family was run. So you probably won't like this parallel, but it's kind of true. In the same way that the emperor or the governor ran their area, so the father was to run the area of his household. Okay, there were those parallels like that. So if you violated on the family level, it was perceived as you would be a violator on the national level. Okay, so Peter is being very astute here by saying, be very careful, you Christians, about these kinds of codes, because people are watching you. So, if you knew that young man who was in the truck yesterday to be a self-declared devout Christian, and he was sitting in that truck while his mother's trying to heave those heavy disc brakes into the truck, your opinion of them would be significantly altered. Right? And so it's that kind of thing that's going on that Peter is trying to address. Jewish people and members of other slandered religious groups sometimes adopted these codes to demonstrate that their groups actually supported values of Roman society, and parenthetically, that were not counter to biblical principles. This demonstration was important in combating persecution. That's why Peter wrote these codes in 1 Peter 2 and 1 Peter 3. Because he was trying to get the believers to assimilate in whatever way they could more completely to avoid, like, in other words, to be low profile in that way, right? Because if people are looking for any excuse to persecute you, why provide additional ones? On the other hand, this too was at play. Given the social context to which the letter is addressed, it seems probable that some Christians are being tempted to conform to the religious and cultural conventions of the society in which they lived in order to avoid persecution. So you have both of these things happening at the same time. Number two, so I just went through the number one reason why this text should be read and why it's important. It's about Peter saying, look, don't attract any undue or any unnecessary attention by violating some of these cultural customs and codes that are not counter to biblical principles. Rather, obey them. Submit yourself to them. But the second applicable exegesis of 1 Peter 2, 13 through 17 is about the nature of relationships of that the Christian has to the state in regard to submission and obedience. And so when I say that, then let me just say this. Most people who read the whole of this text make number two, number one, and number one, number two, if they even know about number one. Does this make sense to you? So for them, as soon as they read this text, they zero in on, oh, what does the Bible have to say about the Christian and the state and its the relationship between the two? Devoid of the much larger context of what is really going on here. So, at least historically, this is becoming less and less true now. Years ago, I believe it was in the Chicago Museum, an artist took an American flag and he taped it on the floor of the museum. And in order to get from this room to the next room, you had to walk over top the American flag. Now, I'm seeing some of your faces and you're like, you know, that's a horrible, that's so anti. Well, your response is that person, that artist, violated a patriotic code that's a part, that has been a part of our nation for over 250 years. And so we see them as being anti-patriotic. Now, that was about 25 years ago. Today, it's almost the reverse in some sectors of our community. To fly an American flag is perceived as being undemocratic and anti-patriotic. So it's a very strange time and world that we live in. So I mentioned earlier, and I just re-mention again because I'm going to get to it, not today, but in a future date. So 1 Peter 2, 13 through 17 then, as it relates to the Christian citizenship of the state and government, ought always to be read in conjunction with Romans 13, 1 through 7. And so we'll get to that. But as I was doing this research, I ran across this, and I just by way of introduction, almost parenthetically, I think I'll share this with you. There are three views of the Christian and the state. I just took a picture of them and put it up on the screen. So by way of introduction, Christians understand Romans 13 in different ways. All Christians agree that we are to live at peace with the state as long as the state allows us to live by our religious convictions. For hundreds of years, however, there has been at least three interpretations on how we are to do this. Number one, some Christians believe that the state is so corrupt that Christians should have as little to do with it as possible, although they should be good citizens as long as they can do so without compromising their beliefs. They should not work for the government, vote in elections, or serve in the military. Frank, does that remind you of anybody that you know? So Frank has a hunting cabin up in the middle of a bunch of Amish people. And this is exactly how they believe. They just have nothing to do with the state, as little as possible. Number two, others believe that God has given the state authority in certain areas and the church authority in others. Christians can be loyal to both and can work for either. They should not, however, confuse the two. In this view, church and state are concerned with two totally different spheres, the spiritual and the physical, and thus complement each other but do not work together. So one of the traditions that this would have belonged to at one time would have been the fundamentalist tradition. And so they see they're dualists. This world really is beyond salvaging. You just kind of hang on until either the Lord comes, you know, I'll see you here, there, or in the air kind of thing. But that's what it is. Number three, still others believe that Christians have a responsibility to make the state better. They can do this politically by electing Christian or other high-principled leaders. They can also do this morally by serving as an influence for good in society. In this view, church and state ideally work together for the good of all. This is a reformed view of the Christian faith and the state. That everything belongs to God. Everything must be used and redeemed for the purpose and work of Christ. That politics belongs to God. And so I've seen many people in the fundamentalist section of the church move over towards this expression here. And it would be my expression as well. Although I will say, I think there can be periods or seasons within the life of a country where the government could be so corrupt that it's impossible to work within that government. It's just impossible. The demands that they have upon you are so severe that it would force you to compromise way too much of your particular faith. I do think that there are countries like that. I know that on the outer fringes that there were Christians who tried to have some influence in Nazi Germany. But in the core of Nazism altogether, it would have been almost impossible to be, I think, a believing, faithful Christian and still work in the way they wanted you to work within the Nazi regime. So, none of these views advocate rebelling against or refusing to obey the government's laws or regulations unless those laws clearly require you to violate the moral standards revealed by God. Wherever we find ourselves, we must be responsible citizens as well as responsible Christians. We believe that if you are a responsible Christian, it necessarily means then that you will be a responsible citizen. But there are people in our society who believe that it is impossible to be a responsible Christian and be a responsible citizen at the same time. That what the state is about is too contrary to what Christians are about. And so there are those people that believe that way. The two primary institutions that have been under attack more than anything are faith and family. And that's one reason why I think this subject, this text here, is so relevant to us, because I think all of us are asking this question. You know, how are we supposed to live? What kind of person am I supposed to be? What are we to do when historically faith and family were treasured as they, you know, they were treasured institutions. And now it would seem as if there are too many, not everyone, but too many elites within the culture that want to change those things about us. It also raises some of these questions that would have been less confusing then, but are more confusing today. And these questions are, for example, what is government? Are NGOs government? Non-governing authorities? In other words, they weren't elected. They weren't even necessarily appointed, but in effect, they still have governing power. Social media, on some level, has governing power within our culture. Enormous power. Enormous power. So should we submit ourselves to them? So if Facebook won't allow you to post anything in Scripture that has a very clear male or female reference to it, they are governing you about what you can post and what you cannot post. So is that government? There are the ruling elite class. These are people who are NGOs. They are normally extraordinarily wealthy. They are oftentimes in charge of vast, huge organizations, in addition to social media. So they would be like the big tech oligarchy. Or how about this? How about the UN? So I don't know if you know this or not, but a former administration signed a treaty with the UN that basically said that almost every firearm that you can think of is outlawed. And that administration signed the treaty with the UN, and the only thing that keeps that from becoming law is the Senate voting on it to ratify it. And if it does, basically then the UN has control over the Second Amendment. Well, you check it out for yourself. It's what it is. So then are we to be subject then to the UN with that or any other kind of thing? The UN's position on abortion, for example, was pretty strong. So should we be subject to them as well in that? I mean, there's a whole host of things. So these are complex issues. And we have to ask ourselves these questions. What is civil disobedience? Is it just protests? Is it nonconformity with gender-neutral language? The state of Florida, years ago, I don't think it went anywhere, but they did pass legislation that's removed all gender-specific language. So it was illegal to use gender-specific language. Is that a violation of our biblical principles? Do we protest against that? Do we have to be subject to that? How about like passive aggressive rebellion? In other words, you're not doing anything like violent, but you're not supporting in an active way. You're not supporting what the government. I mean, is that wrong? Is that not being subject? There are a whole host of those kinds of issues and questions. A whole host of them. I'm just raising the questions. Or how about rebellion when it comes to a just war? Do we determine what a just war is, or does the government determine what a just war is? If the government wants you, if they want to draft you to fight for a war that you don't agree with, that you don't believe is a just war, or if you're a pacifist, what are we not being subject to civil authorities? What constitutes resistance or rebellion? I mean, these can be highly subjective statements, especially today. especially today. In other words, do you know the little meme I sent out to all of you, right? Where this person says, I want to make this decision, and this person says, well, you're free to make that decision, whatever you want. I have my phone shut off for us, I read it. I mean, this is the spirit of our age. And so it concludes by saying, like, well, you won't agree that what I want to do is good, so why do you hate me? Well, I don't hate you. I just don't agree. Well, in order to love me, you must agree with what I want to do. Well, why? Because I don't feel affirmed. That sentiment is finding its way in a whole host of different kinds of things. Like, for example, the National School Board just voted, I believe they passed it, where they would no longer refer to mothers as mothers, but as a birthing parent. So you are not a mother, you are a birthing parent. And if you go to a school board meeting, or if you don't like that to be in the curriculum, is it not being subject to authority? Aren't these the things that are your question? You're like, what do I do with that? How do I remain true and loyal, excuse me, to being subject to civil authority on the one hand, and yet, how can I discern accurately what is being violated in terms of biblical principles? And what is my response to that? At what point can we say, as the apostles did, we must obey God rather than man? At what point can we say, it's the next slide, I think, if it'll come up. There we go. We must obey God rather than man. Because when it comes to authority, all of us have different levels of authority. And the supreme level of authority always wins. So even in the Constitution, right, most state laws are subject to federal laws. Most county laws are subject to state laws. Most township laws are subject to county laws. That's how it works. So for us, God is the person that we are subject to first. And if what the state says runs counter to what God says, and it's clear, then our first default is to God. But there's oftentimes confusion about that, and so that's one reason why we need to understand these things better. So just a couple of comments more, and then I'll be done with this portion of it. So remember that this is a letter written by the Apostle Peter, giving specific instructions related to general societal institutions for enduring current and future persecution. Remember, that's the reason why this portion was written. It's not just about the citizen and government. It's about what we need to do to live better, more effectively in the culture by not unduly attracting persecution that isn't necessary. Third, the dominant majority cultural groups in that day were looking for anything they could use to justify their persecution and poor treatment of Christians. Anything. They were looking for anything. And so that's why the Apostle Peter said, look, obey these codes. Obey these codes. So Peter offers these instructions to avoid providing additional ammunition to those who were critical of and adversarial to Christians. Now, I don't have time to go into this because we want to do the Lord's Supper But my next sermon on this, I will address Romans 13, verses 1 through, I think, 7. And I'll probably lead off with why Christians lived in such an adversarial world. There were three main things that Christians practiced in their life that brought terrible persecution upon them. And I want to be able to unpack them well so you can appreciate the significance of them. And so, in concluding, let me just say, those three things that the surrounding culture misunderstood about Christians, the Christians were completely innocent of. They practiced these three things that were horribly misperceived by the surrounding culture. People began to speak and say things about them in regard to those things. And as I said earlier, at least on the aristocratic level, because Christians were such a minority that those in the aristocracy wouldn't lower themselves to try and understand why Christians practice these things. And so both locally and from the aristocratic portion demographic people, they began to level a lot of critique in issuing persecution against Christians. And Peter's basically saying, you have these three things that you are innocent of, that people are leveraging against you and against us. You have these three things. Don't add any more to those three things unduly. Live and subject yourself for the Lord's sake. Do that so that you don't attract any more undue attention and so that people can see that you are so good at practicing these codes that when somebody says something poorly about you that sounds salacious, they compare that with how good you are in society that they can't make any sense of it. And so they give you the benefit of the doubt. I mean, that's what's going on here. All right? Okay, well, let's conclude in prayer. By the way, any questions? You might have any comments or questions you want to make? Well, give me, is this relevant to you? Is this helpful?
Yes.
Okay, all right.